Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, brought to you by The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. I'm Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation. Each week here on The Breakdown, we take your questions via Twitter at Chris L. Hayes or via email at TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. The way it works is this. You send us questions about what's perplexing you this week in Washington, and we try to break it down.
Will I run to the rock? Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord.
Hello, welcome back to The Breakdown, week 40, episode 40 in a collector series. This week, we are going to talk about Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and the Espionage Act. I'm taking the chair's prerogative to ask a question that I want to know the answer to, which is there's been a lot of conversation about WikiLeaks, obviously, and the U.S. government possibly impaneling a grand jury in Virginia, possibly investigating federal criminal charges against Julian Assange, who is the head of WikiLeaks. These are distinct from the sexual assault charges he's currently facing in Sweden, but actually prosecuting Assange for his role in disseminating and acquiring and then disseminating the documents that have been the subject of so much controversy. And the law that he would be prosecuted under, many people have suggested, is the 1917 Espionage Act. So the question is, can Assange be prosecuted under the Espionage Act, and what would that look like? And to answer that question, I have with me on the line Steve Vladek. He's a professor of law at American University. He's an expert in security, international law, and national security law. Steve, thanks so much for coming on The Breakdown.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I guess the first question is, what is the Espionage Act, and what was the kind of context out of which it emerged?
Sure. I mean, so the Espionage Act was passed in the middle of World War I. It was written because at the time we actually had no federal laws on the books that made it a crime for individuals to basically steal national security secrets from the military, from the government, and to transmit them to a foreign power. I mean, we had passed a smaller statute in 1911 called the Defense Secrets Act, but I think World War I really drove home the need for a more sweeping, more comprehensive bar on the ability of foreign agents, really, and even American citizens, to spy on the U.S. government at the behest of, you know, potential enemies.
So it was the first time that spying was made a federal crime, basically.
Or at least it was the first time it was done so comprehensively. I mean, I think, you know, one can find sort of drips and drabs of spying at other kinds of offenses, including, say, the conversion of property before the Espionage Act. But it was the first time it was prohibited as such.
Okay, so one question that immediately comes to mind is, does the Espionage Act cover foreign nationals? You know, obviously Julian Assange is not an American. There's been lots of sort of, I think, kind of silly talk about accusing him of treason. Sarah Palin accused him of being, quote, un-American. So does the Espionage Act cover foreign nationals as well as American citizens?
I mean, the short answer, Chris, is yes. There's a slightly longer answer, which is that this is one of the many areas where the Espionage Act is profoundly ambiguous. It draws no distinction based on citizenship, and it has always been understood as not distinguishing based on citizenship. And that kind of makes sense. I mean, I think if you had, you know, a rogue foreign agent who happened to be running around Washington or New York or anywhere in the U.S., committing acts of espionage, you know, I think we could understand why Congress would allow the statute to cover non-citizens. What makes Hans trick here is that he's not just a non-citizen, but he's a non-citizen who's not in the United States. I think that's where it looks like a bit more of a stretch, but that's where there is at least a little bit of precedent, one or two cases, where the government has still applied the Espionage Act.
Okay, so that makes sense. I mean, in some ways, right, you would want, given what's happened to the rule of law over the last 10 years, it sounds actually appealing to me, if you did have a rogue federal agent, that you would actually want to prosecute them, you know, in a transparent court of law rather than, you know, sending them off to some black site. So I can understand the logic of subjecting foreign nationals to it. Before we get to the precedents you just mentioned, how has the Espionage Act been used? My sense is that it's been used very, very sparingly through its history.
That's exactly right. It's been used very sparingly, and for the most part, it has been used really only against classic spies. In the 93-year history of the Espionage Act, it's only been used to prosecute leakers three or four times, and indeed, it's only been used to prosecute someone downstream, someone who received leaked information once. So it's a statute that's been on the books for a while. It's often invoked, but in cases like this, it is seldom used, which is part of why there are so many questions about just how far it goes. You know, usually with statutes that are used more often, these issues come up and courts decide them, and that just hasn't been the case here.
So you said that it's been used several times to go after leakers. So these are the people who were actually in the WikiLeaks case. That would be presumably, allegedly, Bradley Manning, who is the private first class, who is alleged to have leaked much of the information of WikiLeaks. Who are the former leakers? I think there's some famous ones, right, who were prosecuted under the Espionage Act.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the government actually threatened to prosecute Daniel Ellsberg, perhaps most famously, for leaking the Pentagon Papers, although that case never really went anywhere. Perhaps a slightly more famous case, there's a guy named Samuel Morris, who was a Defense Department photo expert who leaked images of a new Soviet aircraft carrier to Jane's Defense Weekly, who was prosecuted in the 1980s. But again, I mean, these cases are few and far between. And part of why the government, I think, has been historically reluctant to use it to go after leakers is because it's hard to see where it stops. Once you go after leakers, once you go after folks who receive the leaked information, why can't you go after, say, the press or even private citizens who just happen to read this information in a newspaper?
So that's where we get to the crux of the issue with this, and the place where I find that all this conversation about prosecuting WikiLeaks quite troubling, and that's making this distinction. So you said that there has been an Espionage Act prosecution against someone who received a leak, and that's fairly recent, right? Is that the AIPAC case?
Yeah, that's the AIPAC case. So this is a case that was brought in 2005 against two lobbyists for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the central allegation is that they basically were the go-between, that they took information that was leaked to them by a Defense Department official and then retransmitted it to Israel. And so basically their crime wasn't stealing the information. Their crime was taking it and sending it to the foreign government. And what's telling about the AIPAC case is even though the government survived a motion to dismiss, even though the federal district court said you could prosecute, you know, downstream recipients of classified information, the court was worried enough about potential First Amendment concerns that it imposed a fairly high burden on the government, and one that ultimately the government decided it could not meet. So the AIPAC case actually ended up going nowhere. The government withdrew the indictment a couple of weeks before the trial was supposed to begin. So as a precedent goes, it's not a particularly powerful one, but it is out there.
That's very interesting. So the Ellsberg prosecution ended up not happening. The government withdrew. I mean, Ellsberg is different because he was the actual leaker. In the case, in the single case in which it was brought against a receiver, is that the right word?
Yeah, or a third party.
Right. In the single case in which it was brought against a third party who had received the leaked information, they ended up not actually even going to trial. You know, I guess two things. One is, what does that say about what kind of legal footing they would be on with Assange, A? And B, you know, how much of a departure would this be, and how far a slide down the slippery slope were we to see Assange indicted under the Espionage Act?
Sure. I mean, so to the first part, I mean, I think, you know, what this really goes to show is exactly why the Espionage Act is confusing, because it is incredibly broad in its terms, but it's never really been litigated that way, and it's never been enforced to its terms. And so I think part of why this case is so interesting and potentially important is because, you know, the precedent that's out there isn't really that helpful for the government, but there's still the very real possibility that they could try anyway. By dropping these prosecutions instead of pushing them all the way through, you know, the government has never had to have a court say, no, you can't use the Espionage Act this way. It's basically, it's a sort of Damocles that, you know, hangs over any conversation about redistributing or publishing national security information. I think that dovetails with your second question, right? So why is this case potentially problematic? How could it lead to a slippery slope? Well, if Assange can be prosecuted for doing nothing other than taking classified information and putting it on a wiki, I don't know how there's that big of a difference when you look at, say, the New York Times, that takes the same classified information, quotes from it at length, and posts the cables on its website. And I think that's why you've seen media organizations, law professors, Congress look at this case with such careful scrutiny, because everyone's sort of worried that the elephant in the room is the press.
Steve Vladek is a professor of law at American University. He joined me on the breakdown today just before going to Capitol Hill to testify before Congress, am I right, about this very issue?
Yeah, the House Judiciary Committee is having a hearing later this morning to talk about exactly what we've been talking about.
Well, you got the preview here, although this will be up after your testimony, but this is the audio Cliff Notes version. Steve, I really appreciate you taking the time this morning.
No, happy to join you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
The Breakdown is a weekly production of The Nation magazine and TheNation.com. New audio casts are posted each Friday at TheNation.com and available in iTunes. The Breakdown was produced by Laura Stampler and yours truly. Senior producers of The Nation are Emily Douglas and Ben Wiskita. Comments and feedback should be sent to TheBreakdown@TheNation.com.
Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.